So this class is a kind of add-on because when I finished the last class, I realized that there were a number of things that that I wanted to talk about that I hadn't really talked about. And they were kind of in a very different context. I mean, one of the things that I've said right along is that what I wanted to do in this series of classes was speak to my own experience. You know, not be like some sort of professor or Dharma teacher, sort of saying like, this is what the scriptures say and this kind of thing, but rather speak to my experience of having practiced Vajrayana, highest yoga tantra, for almost 35 years now. And that's on the basis of previously being a scholar of Madhyamaka. As I said, I was at one time a translator of Nagarjuna, although I haven't done anything like that for many, many years. For one reason, I got tired of being a starving scholar, and or maybe an impoverished scholar. I never really starved, although I did eat an awful lot of macaroni and cheese. I just decided that wasn't quite the way for me. So where I left off with the previous talk was with a couple of comments. And just to refresh your memory on one of them, which I'm going to loop back to at a certain point, before I started taking questions last time, I made an observation that many of the deities that you would see in tantric iconography hold a skull bowl. And I didn't want to go too much into that too far, but I wanted to hook that up with something that Edward Whitmont had said, because I had really opened this series of talks with some observations about Edward Whitmont and Gregory Bateson, two philosopher psychologists that I appreciate a whole lot. And Whitmont had made a point that he thought that the way human consciousness, at least in the West, had been developing, was that the way to go forward into the future was through the Grail myth. And I observed that, unfortunately, Whitmont didn't really know anything about Vajrayana, because he would have been very interested to know that many of the tantric deities hold in their left hand a skull bowl, which is filled with blood. And a skull bowl is like a grail, because a grail is chalice, which was said to have held the blood of Christ. So there are these very interesting linkages between the symbolism of Vajrayana and some religious symbolism in the West. And I'm going to go back and forth in this session looking at some of these issues, because they've been very important to me. And I think that looking at some of the historical context of the development, certainly of Western consciousness or Western mind, and I will use those terms interchangeably. Technically, they're different, but I will use them interchangeably just because I'm a little bit sloppy sometimes. Now I've lost track of what I wanted to say. That's terrible. I'm getting old. It really sucks, is all I've got to say about it. Bob's laughing because he's very familiar with the problem. And by the way, you're looking really good, Bob, considering you just had surgery a week ago. I mean, I think that's really great. You're muted, so I can't hear what you have to say. But anyway, just wanted to mention that.
The grail and the skull bowl, really.
Yeah. Kay's, I didn't hear what you said, Bob, but Kay was reminding me of the grail and the skull bowl. So I'm going to go back and forth with a few things here. All right. So let me start with this. It has occurred to me that Buddhist Tantra or Vajrayana really, in a sense, can, I think, be very practically be understood as kind of a symbolic map of the entire mind, of our whole mind, from one end to the other. And when I say from one end to the other, I mean from the basis or the source of our mind, which is often called clear light consciousness. And we've talked about that, and I'll come back to it again, to our waking state consciousness, that it includes everything. And if you think about all the aspects of Vajrayana from that point of view, I think it's helpful because it creates some context. And I'm going to pursue this just for a little bit now, both at the level of looking at some of the the larger scale map, and then talking a little bit more about symbolic practice. So let me do a screen share here. Okay, so there are two things up here for you to look at in the screen share. On the one side is this image of the Lord of Death, usually called Yama. And on the other side is a chart that comes out of a book called Death, Intermediate State, and Rebirth in Tibetan Buddhism, which is a commentary, a translation of a commentary that was put together by Lati Rinpoche and Jeffrey Hopkins. It's been published quite some time ago. If you're curious, you can probably still get copies of it. It's an excellent book. Very skinny, but very complex and informative. Now, the reason I put this chart up on the left is it speaks to the dying process on the one hand. So it starts with the first dissolution, going all the way up to the eighth dissolution. And this is the way in which people die. And in reverse order, it's the way in which they're reborn into the bardo. The way people die is the earth energy element dissolves into the water energy element. Water energy element dissolves in the fire energy element, and so on and so forth. I don't want to get sidetracked by this, but I want to point out this column on the left side where Hopkins has laid out a relationship of all of these elements that are dissolving. And you'll see that he's laid them out with aggregates, constituents, sources, object, basic wisdom. What's called basic wisdom here are the five Dhyani Buddhas, such as Akshobhya, which he describes as the basic mirror-like wisdom, and then he goes on through the other five, and he makes these equivalences. If you were to look really at this map and think about it over a long period of time, you'll see it really is, in fact, kind of a map of the nature of our mind, not just from the point of view of the way our mind dissolves at the time of death, but the way in which our mind is created out of clear light consciousness. And remember that clear light consciousness is always there within us. We just have a very hard time accessing it because it's so subtle and we're so not used to seeing it. It does appear at the time of death, and we do rest in it at the time of death, according to this book, for 3 days, if our body hasn't been, quote, ravaged by illness, unquote. So I don't know how many deaths there are that are like that. But the point is that all this map describes what's there all the time in the clear light consciousness, which is the subtlest mind, at the level of the dreaming mind or the symbolic mind, which is laid out here. And we have these images of the various so-called Dhyana Buddhas, like Akshobhya, Amoghasiddhi, and so on and so forth. But then what's also important is that these things are related to the aggregates or the skandhas, okay? So the form skandha, which is the body, is related to the basic mirror-like wisdom, okay? And on and on. So I'm not going to go into great detail about this. I just want you to know that the map is there. And there are many books that have versions of this type of map, okay? Now, all the things that are laid out in this map appear to our minds in two ways. In the way it's appearing in this map, this is the way things appear to our rational waking state consciousness. But the way things tend to appear to our dreaming metaphoric consciousness, which, by the way, is with us during the waking state, something I'll come back to, okay? This dreaming metaphoric consciousness tends to work more on the basis of images. And when we try to understand those images with our rational waking minds, we can only go so far. We can get some information out of that, but we can also run into trouble. So let's turn our attention for a minute to this image of Yama, the Lord of Death, which is, I mean, kind of suitable since I started off talking about this chart as the stages that bring one into actual death. So Yama, that's the name of the Lord of Death, has quite a number of names, actually. One of the names of Yama is Karma Yama, Karma and Yama. Another name is Kalu Rupa, Kalu time, Rupa form. And yet another name is Dharma Raja, Dharma and Raja. And I want to focus on this latter for just a moment. Excuse me. There are many meanings to the word Dharma. We think of it as the Buddha's teaching. But another meaning of the word Dharma is a thing or an entity. Basically, any item that you're aware of, any phenomenon that you're aware of, that you discriminate as being this and not that, is, roughly speaking, a Dharma. And it's kind of interesting to think about all the different meanings of Dharma, but if we went down that rabbit hole, that would take the whole amount of time that we have for this class. I'm not going to go there. What does it mean to call the Lord of Death Dharma Raja? A Raja is a king. What does it mean to say that death is the king of things? Well, death is the king of things because really what death is transformation, is impermanence, right? So impermanence is the king of things. But the way we relate to a lot of impermanence on the emotional level of our metaphoric dreaming minds is that when things pass away, it's like they die. And the thing that passes away that's most close to us, that's like something that dies, is us. So the Lord of Death really is a symbolic way, and no more, in a sense, no more than a symbolic way of talking about impermanence, the image of impermanence, the image of impermanence that we relate to emotionally. Now, two other things to notice about this image. And I'm just going to mention this because you might want to think about it at some other time. I'm not going to go too deeply into this right now. The Lord of Death has a consort called Chamundi, who's sitting to his left. And he himself is a minotaur. He has the head of a bull and the body of more or less a human being. Chamundi holds in her left hand a skull bowl filled with blood, and in her right hand, she holds a trident. So I talked briefly about the skull bowl filled with blood. There are different ways of understanding it in Vajrayana. I leave it to you to explore that if you want. If you're interested in the similarities with the Grail myth, that would be interesting to explore. In her right hand, she holds a trident. Trident is a traditional symbol, right? A traditional symbol for the three main veins of the energy system that run parallel to the spinal column. Actually, the longer, the sort of the, I don't know, the pole of the trident is called the duty. It's the central channel. And then the two other sides of the trident represent the left and the right hand channels. Idan Pingala in Sanskrit, sometimes called that, or the sun and the moon channels. They represent the central energies. So there's something that's being revealed symbolically here in this image. And the fact that the Lord of Death is a minotaur has a symbolic quality. And I'm going to come back to this a little bit later, but not go into it too far right now. But I do want you to remember this. So let's stop the screen sharing now. Okay, so we've got that. It's important to remember, if you're practicing Vajrayana, that everything that you're doing in the practice is entering into this symbolic world, which you want to have come alive. Now, on the one hand, the symbols all have meanings. I mean, I just talked about the meaning of the trident in very waking state consciousness rational terms, but it refers to something that exists symbolically in another level, which has emotional content to it, just as this Skolbol does, and just as Yama himself does. I mean, if you were to meet Yama in a dream, you'd wake up with heart palpitations. You'd wake up covered with a cold sweat. I mean, this dude is really scary. He's really frightful. Well, everybody's afraid of death unless they've cultivated themselves to not be afraid of death. So the representation of death should be something that's frightful. But why? Why would we want to deal with a frightful image? What would be the point of doing this? Okay. Well, for one thing, all the images that exist within this frame of our mind, as I've said, have energy associated with them. And we can work with that energy. In fact, in Vajrayana, the intention is to work with this energy. I'll remind you again of the metaphor of the horse and the rider, in which the conscious mind is like the horse, the rider is like the energy which carries thoughts or which supports the mind. And the rider directs the energy, directs the horse, and the horse carries the rider, carries the ideas, carries the images. In Tibetan Tantra, there are two levels of practice, usually called the generation stage and the completion stage. The generation stage is all about working with images. But when you've mastered the generation stage, then you get on to the completion stage, and that's working with the inner energies directly. What the generation stage does is it elicits the energies and makes them conscious in ways that you may not have been aware of. When you practice these images, you can feel the energies change within yourself. If you've practiced anything like Tai Chi or Aikido or any of the Asian martial arts, you're familiar with the Chi energy. You're familiar with the energy that exists within the body. So the images, on the one hand, evoke the energy, but on the other hand, they shape the energy, right? So the energy evoked and shaped by Manjushri is associated with wisdom consciousness. But the energy evoked and shaped by, say, Chenrezig, Avalokiteshvara, is associated with compassion consciousness, okay? But in the larger picture, once you've mastered the ability to generate these images with power, with life, and that's associated with understanding that the images are, on the one hand, of the nature of clear light, bliss, voidness, and on the other hand, they are the nature of your own guru. That's what brings them to life with personality. Once you have the ability and the experience to, once you have the ability to meditate with that liveliness and evoke those kinds of energies on a certain level, you actually do move on to the level of completion stage. Whereas Tsongkhapa says, you bring the energies into the central channel and eventually you bring them to reside or absorb or collapse into the heart chakra. The chakra is a wheel. It's the point where the energies exist in certain parts of the body. When you bring that energy into the heart, you directly experience what's called the child clear light. You can read about this stuff in the Hopkins Ladi Rinpoche book if you want. But the point is, you begin to experience that clear light, which is your own Buddha nature. That's an extraordinary achievement. And we all would be remarkably fortunate if we were able to have such an achievement. It requires great powers of concentration. But even without achieving that, it's, for one thing, good thing to know what the whole map is. But even if you can't achieve that, you can still experience the energies in relationship with the different images. So what this overall tantric image map of the mind does, it gives you the opportunity to develop parts of your own mind that are perhaps undeveloped or that you want to cultivate in some way. or that you may have lost along the way for some reason, and you want to bring those things forth. I mean, none of us grows up totally whole. It's impossible to, as far as I'm concerned, it's impossible to escape the family system without pieces of you getting left behind for one reason or another. Even if you have the most loving family, it'll happen. Or it'll happen on the playground, or it'll happen in your job life. You know, things get cut off from us because of circumstance, right? And therefore we're no longer whole. So what Vajrayana is doing now is it's giving us this map, when you learn the map, of what a whole person is, and gives you the opportunity to be able to reclaim parts of yourself that have been lost, or to emphasize parts of yourself that you want to make stronger. When I was translating, I was working in Dharamsala with Geshe Sonam Rinchen in the early 80s. And I just felt like, you know, translating Nagarjuna was just really tough. It was breaking my noggin. I mean, back then I was younger, my mind was fairly clear, but you know, Nagarjuna is no easy business at all. And I was trying to translate the 70 stanzas on emptiness. Every once in a while, again, Sonam Rinchen would ask me questions about what we'd been doing. Put me on the spot. He asked me some question about a stanza we were translating. And I invariably got the wrong answer. And sometimes he would almost fall off his chair laughing. He found it so amusing. What did that make me feel like, right? It's like I was sweating, right? So it's the monsoon season in India, and I'm still sweating, you know, and not because of the heat and the humidity. So I finally said, Genla, I just need to sharpen up my mind. That's pretty clear. So how about teaching me to meditate Manjushri Shri so I can sharpen up my mind, right? So that's the kind of point that I'm wanting to make, is that we can develop these capacities and we can reclaim things. Okay. Now, there's one last thing I want to say about practicing with these images. And then I want to turn to a little bit of history, because that's really the context that I want to make here, is history. First off, it's quite possible for us to wonder whether or not these images in Vajrayana or in Buddhist Tantra would really work for us as Westerners. Excuse me, it seems like my throat's a bit on the dry side today. The humidity in New Mexico today happens to be low, and the pollen count is high. That might have something to do with it. One of the things that I was doing, it was the summer of 82 and the summer of 83 that I was in Dharamsala translating. And I took the opportunity while I was there actually to meet with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and to interview him for a psychology journal, which is called the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology. This relates to the fact that I worked as a counseling psychologist before I decided I was much more interested in being a Buddhist scholar and teacher. that was where my passion was, you know, and I was listening to, what was his name? Joseph Campbell, follow your passion. So I decided to follow my passion, and I left the money behind and became an impoverished scholar. Not sure how smart that was, but anyway. Ultimately, things worked out. I won't go into that. But so I got in touch with His Holiness's private office, told him what I wanted to do, and I was able to have three interviews with him, one in summer of 82, two in the summer of 83, that eventually were published in the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology. It was a very extraordinary experience. He was amazingly difficult to interview because I kept looking in his eyes and then I would forget everything I was trying to do. It was kind of like impossible. Fortunately, I had notes, so I would kind of yank myself back. And I also had a tape recorder, so I didn't have to try and remember anything, which would have been really impossible. But the point of my telling you this story is that one of the questions that I asked him that I thought was a really critical question and had come up among my psychology colleagues at the time was whether or not all this tantric imagery would actually work for the mental transformation of Westerners. particularly in the context of doing psychotherapy, but whether it could work at all. And His Holiness said something that was really interesting, stuck with me all this time. He said, you know, we learned all of this practice from people in India. And people in India are really different than people in Tibet. And that's true. I mean, if you think about it linguistically, if you think about it biologically, if you think about it environmentally, it's hard to imagine people who are any more different. The language families are radically different. Indo-European language versus the Tibetan language, they're very different than each other. And he said, you know, it's been working for us for the last 1,000 years. These images have worked for us for the last 1,000 years, even though we learned them from these Indians who are so different than us. They will work for you too. He was quite certain that that would be the case. So that's something that I think is really important to keep in mind when you consider working with these images. And the images are evocative though, and we do have different histories than the Indians or the Tibetans. So they're going to have a different impact on us than they're going to have on Indians and Tibetans, because we have a different cultural history, okay? And there are certain things that are shared in Euro-American cultural history, and I'm going to kind of do a broad brush when I'm talking about that. And that's kind of the direction that I want to go. For example, well, think about this. If you looked at images of Vajrasattva or Vajradhara, you're looking at an image of a Buddha who has a male and a female aspect, which are in relationship to each other. They embrace each other sitting in a meditation pose. So, you know, Vajrasattva and Vajradhara are understood to be personifications. I mean, that's not a word that you'd find in Tibetan, but considered to be personifications of bliss and voidness. Okay. So the consort, the female, is the voidness, and the male is the bliss. Okay. And so they represent in a personified way bliss, voidness together. Well, I have to tell you something that you probably already know. When Westerners first encountered these images, they sure didn't see bliss voidness. They thought they were seeing sexual obscenity, because that's the mentality that they brought to this. After I completed my PhD, the first place that I taught was a women's college, actually the oldest women's college in the United States, called Mount Holyoke College. And Mount Holyoke used to train people for the ministry. Actually, they trained the wives of ministers to go to wherever and spread the good Christian word. So they had this really extraordinary library of journals that dated back to the second half of the 19th century that were full of the accounts of missionaries who had gone to all kinds of places in Asia and talked about what they had experienced there while they were spreading Christianity. And I gave my students the task of tracking down everything that had been written about Tibet in these journals. And you cannot believe the stuff that these missionaries had to say about Tibetan imagery. You cannot believe it. It was worse than just saying that it was obscene. It's because of what they brought with their own mentality. And it's the reason why so much of the tantric teachings are considered to be secret. So I practiced highest yoga tantra, but there are many things that I can't show you or say, because this is going to be recorded. It'll be available on the internet. And there's good reason why this stuff has to be held in some degree of confidence, because people don't see it within the context that would have it be what it truly is. They see what they project upon it. And this, of course, is a completely human phenomenon, which has both negative and positive aspects. Technically, in Buddhism, You know, if we go back to waking state consciousness Buddhism, and we start talking about the five skandhas, you know, the Buddha asks the question, where is the I? Where is the person? And the answer to that question is, of course, that I is a concept, is an idea that is designated upon the five skandhas of body and mind. Not that the I doesn't exist, but that it doesn't exist in the way we think it exists. Certainly I feel I feel me, I feel an actor in everything I do. There's some truth in that, but there's a lot of falsehood in that also. But the point is that our natural tendency is to designate an I on our body mind. What Tantra does, which is so interesting, is it uses that natural tendency, and it says, in practice, designate I onto an image of Manjushri. And that's how you cultivate the wisdom aspect of yourself. Designate I onto Avalokiteshvara, Chenrezig. That's how you cultivate the compassion aspect of yourself. And this process is going on all the time. And I want to sort of spread this process out in a broader sense. Right now you're looking at me and listening to me. And especially those of you that know me look and they see David. Right now, as far as you're concerned, you're listening to David. No problem. You understand my words. You see my image. I've got a little bit of a beard, bald head. You know me pretty well. Well, guess what? That's not what's going on at all. You're looking at a computer monitor. You're looking at thousands of pixels generating little bitty light bops, blobs, whatever, all right? And your mind takes all these little bitty bits of light, puts them together into what it takes to be an image, because it creates that image. We've already gone through this. And it designates David onto that image. And by the way, if you're looking at yourself now on the screen, you're designating Mary Camille onto that image. You can't escape doing it. It is what we do. It's what we do with everything. Right? We're constantly designating meaning and personality onto everything around us. It's what human beings do. And there are good reasons for that, and there are problematic reasons for that. But what we mostly don't do is notice that moment by moment, it's what we're doing all the time. Okay, when you're practicing Tantra with images, you're designating yourself onto those images. Okay, we've been through this. But here's my point. For modern people to be doing this is different than for more archaic people to be doing this for very good reasons. Okay, now think about this for a moment. Here's something I tell my university students that at first shocks them. Sometimes it shocks the Dharma students too. Shakyamuni Buddha was illiterate. Now that sounds awful. Oh my God, the Buddha was illiterate. Well, guess what? At the time of the Buddha, there wasn't any writing. There were no books. He couldn't be anything but illiterate. Okay, but what does that mean? How have our minds been shaped by the fact that we're literate? I'll give you a very, very simple example of this. Okay. Think about time, past, present, and future. Okay. If you think about time in relationship to your physical body, I'm going to bet that the past is on the left and the future is on the right. Because we read from left to right. It's not because the past is on the left and the future is on the right. It's because we read from left to right. What we read in the past is to the left, and what we're going to read in the future is to the right. We're programmed this way. Unless, of course, you are Arab. You're an Arab. Because Arabic script is written from right to left. So their past is to the right, and their future is to the left. And if you were a Chinese living 1,000 years ago, you wrote from top to bottom. So your past was up there and your future is down there. Okay, this is the way things get shaped. Okay, so I think it's really important to understand some history if we're going to understand how we approach Tantra. Now, the Buddha famously said that if you were shot by an arrow, especially if you were shot by a poison arrow, the only thing that would really matter is pulling the arrow out fast. You wouldn't care who made the arrow. You wouldn't care who shot the arrow. You would just want to pull it out before you were poisoned by it. All well and good, but I'll bet that everybody listening to what I have to say is college educated, or most everybody is college educated. And as a result of that, we want to know who made the arrow. We want to know who shot the arrow. We need to understand what's going on. Because, and we're not born Buddhists, probably. So if we're coming to practice Vajrayana, we're coming to Tantra. Why am I doing this? Why would I do this? Why would anybody do this? We need an explanation. If you're born in Tibet 100 years ago, you wouldn't need an explanation. It's like, this is the world. This is what people do. This is what reality is. This is my reality. This is my culture. You'd be completely enmeshed in it. You wouldn't be asking this question. But that's not who we are. So I'm going to do something un-Buddhist. I'm going to say, we need to explore who shot the arrow, who made the arrow, who fashioned the bow. Why did they shoot you with it? That this is important. Because the arrow is our own ignorance. The arrow is what we don't know. And not only do we need to do something about our own ignorance, we need to know something about the nature of our ignorance, which is maybe different than the nature of the ignorance of Tibetans. And when I say ignorance, let me be clear, I do not mean stupidity. I mean what's called in Sanskrit avidya, the basic human problem that the Buddha pointed at, which is misknowing. Much better word than ignorance, but misknowing is kind of a clumsy English word. So the usual translation is ignorance, so I use that word. Okay, so the point is, how did we get to the way we are? Because that says something about what we're going to do in the practice of Tantra. You know, it's pretty hard for us to look at any of the tantric images that are in the yab-yum, male-female relationship, and not someplace in the back of our minds have something going on which wonders, isn't there something sexual going on here? I mean, does Vajrayana have a penis? What's going on here? Okay, it's even if we push it out of the way, I think it still lurks there in the back of our minds. And when we first approach the images, it's not in the back of our minds. Okay, I don't want to beat this horse to death, as they say. So let's do a little bit of history here. Some time ago, I talked about the Reformation and Gregory Bateson's idea that the Catholic Church had these powerful sort of magical rituals called the Mass, that at the time of the Reformation, something happened. And the rational mind pushed the symbolic upon these images, which were taken to be literally. So in the Catholic Church, what the Mass does, to refresh this, what the Mass does is through the priest, the bread is converted to the body of Christ, the wine is converted to the blood of Christ, and because they are actually the blood and the body of Christ through this magical ritual, which you are then able to imbibe, you can eat the body, you can eat the blood, we won't go into the somewhat cannibalistic aspect of this, but you can absorb the body and blood of the Savior into yourself and thus be saved through this magical ritual. In the Reformation, the Protestants said, no, that's all symbolic. And all the bloody wars that were fought were over this particular issue, because if it's symbolic, it doesn't have the magical quality to save you. Now, some people might say, that what came out of the Reformation, which was the Enlightenment, among other things, was the generation of rational consciousness, which is the modern way of knowing things through science, through logic, and whatnot. And the received story about human history that historians and anthropologists, for example, have been telling us is that in very ancient days, people were hunter-gatherers, and they settled in farming communities, and they were more successful in their farming, so they built cities, then there was specialization of labor, and then there was, you know, hierarchical development of rulership, the development of writing to keep records, and so on and so forth, and that led through this whole evolutionary progression to where we are now. And actually, Whitmont follows that view of reality. It's easy to say that the ancient peoples were not rational. They may not have been logical in the way in which we're logical. They may have not been scientific in the way in which we're scientific. That does not mean they were not rational. If you look at indigenous people who didn't go through the Western process of development, they're extremely rational. Their waking state consciousness works really well. It's only a Western arrogance, ethnocentrism, et cetera, that considers indigenous people to be, quote, primitive and therefore not rational. In fact, it's probably easier, and some anthropologists are now moving in this direction to say this, it's probably easier to say that modern people have lost something really essential that indigenous people have kept, which is to say, we've lost the ability to live in the mythic mind without treating it as only a symbol. Because we have to bring our rational minds into the mythic realm, and therefore we say it's symbolic. And it becomes a challenge to practice Vajrayana, for example, and have it come alive as not only being symbolic, but being actually alive and true in a vital, energetic way. For indigenous people, not a problem. They can be perfectly rational, and they can also enter the mythological, and is perfectly alive, right? We've actually lost something in historic development. So we have this challenge, if we're trying to recreate our wholeness by engaging in tantric practice with these images and stepping into the mythic mind, we have a challenge. And the challenge is to become, in a sense, like indigenous people, to bring the mythic into full life. And why, right? Because of all the richness of energy and completeness that exists there. We're not complete anymore. We've cut ourselves off, sort of, except we really haven't in some ways, right? Because there are many ways in which we spend an awful lot of time engaged in this imagistic world. How many people spend how much of their time sitting in front of a television set? They're designating reality onto a bunch of pixels, as it were. They're creating fantasy realities, which are probably not very wholesome. My wife and I like to go to the movies, or at least we did before the pandemic. Like to go to the movies so we can sit in a black space with a bunch of other people and share a dream together. It's really profound to go into a black space and share a dream together. We want to do it. As human beings, we want to get into that place. Unfortunately, most movies are not very wholesome either, right? Vajrayana offers us the opportunity to create our own internal movie, which is wholesome, which completes us. Now, I want to go back again to this business of the development of consciousness, which is called an evolution, which sometimes leaves out parts that are important. And I want to push back a little farther. If you push back into the origins of Western civilization, it's often said that Western civilization is founded on the coming together of Greek philosophy and Judaic religion coming together. When I say Judaic religion, for Western thought, I'm mostly talking about Christianity, which in its beginnings was in fact a sect of Judaism. And then it became something else. But it started out that way. And it brought with it certain elements of mind, which were in the Judaic world. But let me shift for a minute to the Greek side of things. Okay. And I want to put the Greek side of Greek philosophy into a certain kind of context. There was what was once considered hypothetical history, which was that in very ancient days, the very ancient days, we're talking about maybe 4,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, the primary image of deity, the primary image of that which is divine, was female, was the goddess. And it sometimes said that those were a matriarchal time, and that that was associated with agricultural cultures, which makes sense because of the cycle of agricultural development, where the corn grows, corn in a general sense of that which is producing seed. The corn grows, you save some of the seed for the next planting of corn, you eat some of it, and then the seed produces more seed, right? And primitive people had enough sense to look at male and female, and they understood that male continuity was limited, but female continuity was never limited. When women come out of the body of women, femaleness just goes forward from one generation to another. When males come out of the body of women, that's it. Males end. They don't give birth to anything physical, that is, right? So they understood femaleness as having a certain kind of continuity. Well, something that happened several thousand years ago across the Indo-European world was nomadic peoples invaded across the Indo-European world. Nomadic peoples invaded and conquered and dominated the farming cultures where the goddess was primary. And in their world, the sky gods were primary. Maleness was primary. They were warriors. They were herders. Okay. This happened in India. Those people were called Aryan people. They're associated with the Vedas. It happened throughout Eastern Europe. And it happened in Greece. When you read about Greek myths and you read about the gods and goddesses in Greek myths, you're reading about patriarchal, as they're called, deities. You're looking at a religion which is hierarchical and male-centered and dependent upon these earlier invasions. And patriarchy is a good word for what these civilizations are. When these kinds of ideas were first emerging, a lot of the women that I knew talked about the matriarchy. The time the matriarchy, before the patriarchy took over, and the matriarchy was so wonderful. It was all about relationship, and it was, you know, women were in charge and so on and so forth. But one thing that ought to be clear here, which was not so clear at the time, was women in charge, matriarchy. This is a way of taking a mentality which is associated with the stratification and the heroic view of human beings that's in male-dominated patriarchal culture, and applying that mentality to female culture. We really have no idea what the social organization was of these cultures that viewed the female deity as primary. We just don't know, because it's so far in archaic times. It's before writing, right? We don't know how they were organized. And so everything is dangerous in the sense of projecting into it. Now, why am I even talking about this in the context of talking about Tantra? It's because it's our mental heritage. Just as Christianity is our mental heritage, which is separated off male and female, Jesus and Mary, and made the male dominant and subsumed the female. Oh, we've got Mary out there, but really it's all about Jesus. And it doesn't work, right? Because in our minds, we want Mary back. We want the female in some way. I mean, here in Santa Fe, Guadalupe is the big deal, right? I mean, it has to come back, but how does it come back? How does it function in the mind, right? Well, Mary is sweet. She's the mother. She's the savior. She's the one that cares about you. And by the way, she's a virgin. Okay, so this is the only kind of female energy that's allowable, virginal female energy. This is what goes on in our minds, right? Okay, so those Protestant missionaries that went to Tibet and they saw images of Vajrasattva or whomever, man, they didn't even relate to Mary. What was going on in their minds when they saw this kind of stuff, okay? Maybe some of the Catholic missionaries might have seen something about Mary and Jesus, but holy cow, they're embracing. Whoever saw a picture of Mary and Jesus embracing, except when Jesus was taken off the cross, right? Okay, this is the mentality of the Western mind that we've inherited. So I want to push back farther to the origins of this, because in Vajrayana, in Tantra, that's what we're doing. We're excavating into this complex whole history of the way the Western mind is developed, because that's how our minds are. And we're trying to recompose the whole. We're trying to bring forward that which has been suppressed. We're trying to emphasize that which we've lost. Okay, so here I'm going to push back farther, as far as we can. And I'm going to push back to one myth that has really stuck in my mind over the years, because this is about what's stuck in my mind. That's what we're talking about here today. I'm sorry, it's me. I'm telling you what's been important to me, okay? This is the myth of Theseus and the Minotaur and Ariadne and Dionysus. And if you've read any philosophy, Dionysus will be familiar with you, because the philosopher, 19th century philosopher Nietzsche said that the Western mind had split into the Apollonian and the Dionysian in its character. The Apollonian being the rational, the Dionysian being the emotive undercurrent, the unconscious, where the passions are, right? He called it the Dionysian. He went back to Greek myth to look at this. But I want to go back to the actual Greek myth. Now, Nietzsche was onto something, right? Okay. And if you look at the origins of Christianity and the way the mind was split in the origins of Christianity, you'll see the origins of the Dionysian and the Apollonian in the Western mind. Unfortunately, what the Greeks called Dionysian, the early Christians called the devil, which is kind of a whole interesting thing to explore, because the Dionysian was all about the earth. It was all about passions. It was all about relationship with the feminine. Don't want to go too far into that. I want to go back to this Greek myth. The way the story goes is that the king of Crete, which is this large island in the center of Mediterranean, which used to very definitely be a goddess-oriented culture. We know that from looking at the frescoes that have been excavated. I'll come back to that in a minute. The king of Crete conquered Athens. All right. So at this time, obviously, Crete was a patriarchal society, it was a warrior society. And he demanded in tribute that 7 Athenian male youths and female youths be sent to Crete as a sacrifice. Why? Because the king's wife had a sexual relationship with a bull that came out of the ocean, sent by one or the other of the Greek gods, I can't remember which, and she gave birth to a minotaur. She gave birth to a son that had the head of a bull. Remember minotaurs? Yama? Okay. And everybody was so freaked out about this that they made the minotaur live in a labyrinth, which was basically a complicated basement under the palace. Okay. What the mythologists would tell us this means is that in ancient cultures, especially goddess-oriented cultures, the goddess had a consort. The consort usually had horns. He was often a bull, or he may be a male-type figure with horns, right? Bull was the traditional consort of the goddess. So what is the Minotaur, right? The Minotaur is the traditional concept, the traditional consort of the goddess that by being forced to live in the labyrinth, symbolically we're being told, in this new patriarchal culture has been forced into the underground, which is the unconscious, right? So this culture has already split into conscious, unconscious, okay? And the whole relationship with the goddess has gotten dicey. Okay, so Theseus is one of the seven youths who's sent to Crete as sacrifice. He happens to be the son of the king of Crete. In other words, he's not just a warrior noble, he's a heroic figure. So Joseph Campbell has written a lot about the hero myth. You can read about this pretty easily. When Theseus gets to Crete, one of the daughters of the king sees him and falls in love and says, I don't want you to be eaten by the Minotaur. And being eaten by the Minotaur could mean many things, not least of which is the patriarchal being reabsorbed into the matriarchal, to use that kind of language. But again, I'm not going to go there, right? She says, I don't want you to die. You're beautiful. I love you. Here's a sword that you can use to kill the Minotaur. Now, the thing was that everyone got lost in the labyrinth. So she says very cleverly, take this spool of yarn. So this is all feminine wisdom now, spool of yarn. Attach it to the entrance to the labyrinth and unspool it as you walk into the labyrinth, because then you'll be able to follow it back out. So Theseus takes the sword, goes into the labyrinth, finds the Minotaur, and he kills him. Okay. In other words, he kills the consort of the goddess. This is major patriarchal religion. But it has hints of something going on that even the Greeks had started to forget, that speaks to something much more archaic about the consort of the goddess. Okay. Kills the Minotaur, comes back out. Theseus and Ariadne. So now we have the son of the king of Athens and the daughter of the king of Crete, right? Elope, and they head back to Athens. They get as far as the island of Naxos. And what happens? They spend some time there. Ariadne wakes up one morning. Theseus has dumped her. He set sail, he's left her behind. Okay. Very patriarchal. Pretty bad. Okay. But then what happens? Another semi-divine figure by the name of Dionysus shows up at Naxos and rescues Ariadne, marries her, and they have children, takes care of her. What does this mean symbolically? What's happening here is that different aspects of the psyche are interrelating in very complex ways to understand it in this way. And one thing that's going on is the consort of the goddess, in other words, the energy that is the yab yum, the yab on the side of the yum, if you will, has push the feminine energy out of consciousness entirely. That's what it means to abandon Ariadne on the island of Naxos. But then another part of the conscious mind, which is represented by Dionysus, reunites with her. Okay, and so back now to male and female in relationship, male consciousness and female consciousness, bliss voidness in relationship. But what do we know about Dionysus? The Greeks said Dionysus was the god of intoxication. He was associated with wine. He was associated with bacchanalian rituals. He was associated with complete sexual abandonment and all kinds of passions. What does it mean? It means in the Western mind, the only way that most Western consciousness can experience the deep erotic nature of feminine consciousness in relationship to it is to get smashed, drunk, intoxicated, and to release all this kind of energy. That's what the Greeks are telling us. That's what was going on for them. The only way that they could reclaim their whole self was through the Dionysian Bacchanalian orgies, to use that kind of language, okay? This is our inheritance. And if you think it's something that's, oh, well, just this Greek myth, you know, what does this relate to? Go to a football game. Go to a soccer match. Oh, especially go to a soccer match in England, where people get rip-roaring drunk. And if their team loses, then there's a big pitched battle with the tribal supporters of the other team. Blood is shed. There's got to be a lot of police around. Okay. What's being released? Man, it's all that Bacchanalian kind of stuff in the modern world, because that's the way people release that stuff. They don't have any clue how to integrate these different aspects of themselves. They're split. Well, you don't have to be a football fan to have this problem. I'm here to tell you. Lots of people have this problem. It's all around us. You can see it hanging out there in American politics right now, big time, right? So it is the contemporary problem. And in my view, and this has always been my view, is Vajrayana mixed with waking state Buddhist philosophy offers a way to redress what we have lost in our so-called evolution and our so-called rational development. Now I'm going to shift back to Buddhist philosophy, and I'm going to drop another word into this conversation, which is bodhicitta. Okay, I've been talking about a lot of stuff, but I haven't talked about bodhicitta. For one thing, the usual view is that female-dominated cultures are more about relationship, more about responsibility, more about the whole than about the individual heroic warrior. That's the difference between the patriarchal and the matriarchal, to use that language. And by the way, now there's a lot of evidence for the fact that these patriarchal invasions really did take place. You know, literal archaeological evidence. In fact, there's evidence now that's coming out, which is genetic evidence. You know, they can read the genome, and so they can look at the genome of ancient peoples and see things that happened in the past. And these warrior invasions are for real, when they're our heritage. Okay, back to bodhicitta, right? Someplace around here in Santa Fe, I ran into this statement about the difference between the indigenous people here, sometimes called Indians or Native Americans. There's a lot of language about this. Seems a lot of people around here like to call themselves Indians, like we have the Institute of American Indian Art. Native people say something different than modern Western people. Modern Western people say, I have rights. Native people say, I have responsibilities. I have responsibility to my community. I have responsibility to the others around me. Modern people say, I have rights to do what I want to do. And boy, do we see this played out in modern culture big time now, especially in American politics. Don't tell me to wear a mask. I don't care. You know, wearing a mask may be good for the health of the community, but it's pretty damn inconvenient to me. I'm not wearing a mask. And if the school board says that my kids have to wear a mask in school, I'm going to go to the school board and threaten school board members with death. As a matter of fact, the FBI is now tracking this stuff because it's so real. All right. This is all about the way in which the collective is broken down under the weight of individual, quote, rights, unquote. Okay. What is the Bodhisattva path doing? When we practice Vajrayana, when we practice Tantra for the benefit of all beings, what we're doing is we're saying, my actions are relevant to the whole of the community, writ large, which is all the beings of the planet. Not just the human beings, all the beings of the planet. Truly ecological. Not just the beings that are on two legs in Santa Fe, but the beings that are on four legs in Santa Fe, have wings in Santa Fe, and in the rest of the world. This is what the Bodhisattva path is. It's saying, I have responsibility for everything that lives and is aware. And I can do something which is going to benefit everything that lives and is aware. Dalai Lama says, if we want world peace, we have to start by finding peace within ourselves. We can't do anything about creating world peace unless we're peaceful, right? Okay. We can't do anything about making the world whole unless we are whole, because we don't even know what a whole world would look like unless we're whole. We only know what a fractured world would look like. Okay, so here we have a path for becoming whole. And I put this path in a historic context because as Westerners, what we need to do is a little bit different than what Tibetans need to do, because we bring a different mind and a different history to the practice of Vajrayana. Right? So I think it's important to understand these things. And what I've tried to do here is just put out a few concepts so that if you're really curious, you could continue to explore this some more. Because it's all relevant as far as I'm concerned, you know, totally relevant. It's not just relevant in the sense that, okay, yeah, we understand the conflicts between Protestants and Catholics and what happened in the Reformation, but it goes back farther. It goes back farther than the split of the Western mind between the Apollonian and the Dionysian, between the solar god and the god of the earth. And it goes farther back into Greek history. You know, these splits are very deep, right? So in Vajrayana, we have the opportunity to do excavation into our own minds, bring these things forward. So I showed you a map of the larger mind. All these different bodhisattva images are different parts of ourselves, which we can cultivate. They're of relevance to us individually, because among other things, again, as the Buddhists say, the practice of wisdom is for yourself. The practice of bodhicitta compassion is for everybody else. So we have to develop ourselves. And on top of everything else, we're all going to die. It's good to know what the process is, right? And on top of everything else, we're all going to grow. And on top of everything else, we all have relationships. So all these things come together. So that's it. I don't have anything else to say. That was a lot. I just gave you the big picture in world history as related to the Buddhist path. But it's how I've seen things. I mean, it's the way I trained as a scholar, was to understand the history of the Eurasian world. And then I trained to understand Buddhist philosophy. And then I've been practicing Tantra for a long time. So it's just how I see things. But I think it's a useful vision. I hope you find it useful. So, if you want to unmute and you want to toss any questions at me, go right ahead.
I just want to say fascinating, man. Fascinating.
Glad you liked it, Bob. And I'm glad you're looking so good. Bob just had some major surgery. And we've been having a lot of conversation for this because in time I'm up to go through what possibly what he went through or possibly something different. But we have the same heart issue. So we've been commiserating and sharing prayers for each other through this process. Can barely hear you, Bob. But anyway, Steve has a question.
Oh, David, thank you for such a great lecture. It's always so interesting to hear you talk. And I get this is just like a quick question to start the ball rolling, maybe. Sure. But you mentioned waking state Buddhism, and I presume you're talking about like the sutra approach.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry, my head got really big. I wanted to get more light on me. Isn't there something about the big head in some, never mind, I'm thinking of some sort of Saturday Night Live humor or something along those lines. Yes, so back to your question. Yeah, sutra is like waking state consciousness. All the teachings about the skandhas, Madhyamaka, all that stuff is waking state consciousness teaching. But it's not unrelated to Tantra, of course. And by the way, I'll share something else. This is a theory of my wife's, which I think makes a lot of sense, but there's no evidence for it. You know, the story of the Buddha, I mean, it's probably all a myth. You know, I mean, this is probably heretical to say in any FPMT organization, but probably the story of the Buddha's life is pretty mythic. We don't know really what elements might have been there. That doesn't make it any less important, because as you must know by now, I think myths are sometimes more important than so-called actual reality. Okay. Anyhow, you know, he's a prince and he has the four sights, which include old age, sickness, and death, this kind of stuff. And he gives up his princely life. And he goes off in the forest and he learns to meditate under various masters. And he's more competent than any of them. He becomes this extraordinary, you know, yogi with incredible powers of concentration and renunciation too. Who were those dudes out in the forest? You know, I mean, the only thing we know about them is that some of them became his disciples later, right? Some of them rejected him. But who were those dudes out in the forest who were doing all this stuff, okay? It's traditional all over the world. When a dominating culture, a conquering culture, overcomes an indigenous culture, for the holy people of that culture, the medicine men of those cultures, to go off by themselves into the woods, into the forests, into the mountains, to escape the repression of the dominating culture. So Kay's view, and I think she's absolutely right about this, I think this was a brilliant insight, is that at the time of the Aryan conquest of the indigenous people, who were a goddess-oriented, quote, matriarchal people, many of the holy men, rather than put up with the class system or the caste system that was imposed on them by the new dominating culture, they just constantly went off into the forest so they could do their own meditation and spiritual practice, right? Which means they carried that matriarchal, that feminine-oriented wisdom with them into the forests. It's often said that by scholars anyway, that Tantra is something that was developed later in Buddhist history, that it didn't originate with the Buddha. Well, I think that the Buddha understood it all perfectly well, right? But it doesn't mean that he taught it to all the people around him. He probably taught it to some of the people around him, and they carried those traditions on. And those traditions came forward as Buddhism developed, because that's when they were needed. Buddhism has its own history. I said the Buddha was illiterate. There were no books at his time, but eventually there were books and people became literate. They needed different kinds of teaching when they became literate. And as Buddhist cultures developed, they needed all kinds of different teachings, and things that were submerged, so-called peripheral, maybe were the things that became absolutely essential later on. And Tantra was one of them. I mean, you can go back to Madhyamaka. I am getting a little aside here, but let me just go off on this riff. You can go back to Madhyamaka and say, I mean, who the heck is more rational than Nagarjuna? Hard to find anybody more rational and logical than Nagarjuna. But you know the story of Nagarjuna? Okay. He was a teacher in some versions at Nalanda, although historically that's probably not very likely. But he was a great teacher. And at the assemblies of the students who came to hear him teach, he noticed that there were these two young men in the background, the very far ends of the audience who would come to his teachings. And whenever they showed up, he could smell sandalwood, wonderful sandalwood smells. And then they'd leave and he wouldn't smell it anymore. And at one point, he just was so curious. At the end of one of his talks, he buttonholed them. Well, of course, they didn't have buttonholes, but you know what I mean. He buttonholed them. He said, why is it that whenever you two show up, I can smell sandalwood, and when you leave, I can't smell any? And they said, oh, well, this is because we're Nagas. We're not people. And we think human beings stink. So we cover ourselves with sandalwood paste whenever we come to hear your teachings. Well, why do you come to hear my teachings if you're Nagas? Well, when the Buddha Shakyamuni was teaching, there were some things he taught that he gave to us that were treasures that we kept at the bottom of the ocean in our Naga palace, waiting for somebody who would know what these teachings really meant. And you know what? We think it's you. You want to come with us to our Naga palace at the bottom of the ocean and see these teachings that the Buddha entrusted to us? He said, absolutely, let's go. So he went to the Naga palace, and what he learned were the perfection of wisdom teachings, which had been hidden there. And he brought them back to the land of waking state consciousness, because obviously he went into his deep level of consciousness, into his own mythic mind, and he brought out these teachings which had been hidden in there. And that's what he began to teach. So myth is interwoven in anything as rational as Madhyamaka. It's there. It's just not escapable. It's always there. Okay, that was a long answer to your question, Stephen.
But I love it. It's so interesting, though, and there's so many resonances that come up. I could keep asking questions, you know, for the next hour. I don't want to like impose on you. I've got, if I may, if no one else wants to go, I'd like to ask just, one question.
Yeah, this hold on. Back. Yeah, I'm going to come back again.
Of course, got it.
Okay, I had to do that little thing with my camera because I fuzzed myself out when I moved around too much.
Yeah.
Okay, your question.
You mentioned the Dionysian side of the psyche.
Yeah.
And its kind of relationship to Vajrayana. I really don't know very much at all about Vajrayana, and my grasp of sutra is just very tenuous. So, but getting into that, is there a correlate between some kind of like physical intoxicant, like wine or maybe plant substances, and something that happens in the mind of the Vajrayana practitioner? I could only like speculate, maybe it's like strong levels of emotion or something like that. Would you care to discuss that?
Yeah, there's a couple ways to answer that question. One is that the nature of the clear light mind is, as they say, bliss voidness. Bob Thurman likes to talk about it as orgiastic bliss. I don't much care for that term. But what he's trying to get at is they're talking about big time, knock you off your cushion, bliss. And bliss is hardly even the word for what it is. So I've had little tastes of it, and it's ecstatic. It's wonderful. I like the word beatific. It's much more in resonance with the Western mind. You know, the Western saints used to have these experiences of meeting Jesus, for example, and they would experience what was called ecstasy. And ecstasy is a technical term, if you look at it, the roots of it, for being out of your body. Going out of your body with beatific joy, bliss. They would literally be transported out into other realms. That's how profound the bliss was. Okay. So that's one way of answering the question, okay? The other way of answering the question is, what's in the skull cup? You're muted, Stephen.
They say, Robert Beer here says it's blood.
Everybody says
it's some kind of nectar, yeah.
It's the nectar of bliss voidness. It is blood. I mean, remember, we're in this danger zone of bringing the rational mind into trying to understand what is not symbolic, but what is actual in the realm of myth or in the realm of dream, right? So you could say it's blood and it has a symbolic meaning, but in the level of its experience, that is something else that's going on. And that's pretty much all I can say about it. Without, on the one hand, breaking my vows, and on the other hand, trying to speak about something that's still very mysterious to me. There's something very profound and mysterious here. And if I was to shift to Western language, if I'm right, that the Skullcup is like the Grail. Okay. If you look at the Grail stories, especially the Grail as related to the Arthurian myths. Okay. So these stories emerged about 800 years ago, I think it was. And who knows what they're based on. But in the Arthurian stories, at least as little as I understand them, Arthur is wounded. And because Arthur is the king, the status of the king is the status of the kingdom. This is traditionally ancient world. So Arthur is wounded and he can't be healed, right? And so he wastes away. And as he's wasting away, the kingdom wastes away. The crops don't grow. People are in conflict. All this horrible stuff is going on. And I don't remember how it is, but somehow in the story, if one of the knights of the round table could find the Grail that contains the blood of Christ and bring that to Arthur, it would heal him. And in fact, one of the knights does. I mean, almost all of them fail. And one of them does succeed. I can't remember which one it is. I want to say Galahad, but I'm not sure that it is. Bob, you're going to tell me who it is? You're muted, Bob. You're muted, Bob. All right, well, stay muted then. Anyhow, one of them succeeds in finding the Grail. He brings it back to Arthur's palace, and he gives the Grail to Arthur to drink from. And he's rejuvenated. He comes like back to life again. And the land is healed when the king is healed. Okay. And everything is fructified and bears fruit, becomes wholesome again. Okay. So that's what the Grail tells us, the Grail myth tells us. So maybe that's what the Skullcup does. I don't know. Okay, Stephen. Any more questions? We're kind of running out of time here, but I'm glad to take any other questions. Yeah, Mary Camille.
Yeah, David, what was the name of the Jeffrey Hopkins text?
The light is bad for this. Death, Intermediate State and Rebirth in Tibetan Buddhism, translated by Hopkins and Lati Rinpoche, copyright. Let me get the light here. Snow Lion Publication, first published 1979. You want the ISBN? Do you want the ISBN?
Oh, sure. Thank you.
You don't want the ISBN. Okay, that's
fine. Oh, no. Yes, I do.
Okay. 0-9379388-00-9. I'm sure you can find it at a used bookstore someplace.
Thank you.
It's a great book. Complicated. It's based upon a Tibetan text that goes into great detail about the dying process, about clear light, and you know, Hopkins is a great translator. And Lati Rinpoche was a great yogi. He was extraordinary. Bob, by the way, in case you didn't know it, Lati Rinpoche was one of Segyu Rinpoche's main teachers. Okay. Taratoku was an important teacher of his, but Lati Rinpoche was his main teacher. So that would be relevant to you. You're frozen. I can see your image is frozen because you have a stone face, very unlike you. Okay, I guess that's it. Thank you. It's been my pleasure. Good afternoon or good evening, wherever you are.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.